You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Michael McFaul, the host of World Class and director of FSI. As tensions grow between China and the U.S., the effects are felt across Asia. The Southeast, in particular, is caught between these superpowers. And if the conflict escalates, it could become a battleground for a new Cold War between China and the United States, or some people claim. How and why are the questions we're going to try to answer today? We're going to be speaking with Don Emerson, who is a senior fellow at FSI, and he is the director of the Southeast Asia Program at APARC. He has followed this region for decades, can I say, Don? And you're the perfect person, therefore, to tell us why we might stumble into a conflict, but how we're going to avoid it. We're going to do both of those. Thanks for joining the program today, Don.
My pleasure.
So let's just situate what Southeast Asia means, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. I'm not sure all of our listeners will know exactly what we mean. So let's define what that region is first before we get on to other matters.
Well, one way of defining Southeast Asia is simply to say that it is located roughly between two large and ancient civilizations, India to the west, China to the northeast. It's kind of a flyover zone, in a way, between those two.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, in fact, it was, during the Cold War, called a shatter zone, a Balkans, because it consists of 11 different countries, which are very, very diverse. And there has been outside involvement during the colonial era, French, the British, and so forth, and the Americans in the Philippines. So it's a natural place where you would imagine conflict could arise. Now, there are 11 different countries in Southeast Asia: Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Laos, Malaysia, Myanmar, the Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam.
That was incredible that you just did that. Keep going.
Well, I mean, you know, you work on a place long enough. Anyway, those 10 countries are members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Now, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations has done a lot of good work. And to its credit, it is fair to say that no two members of the association have ever gone to war with each other. Now, that was not true in the period of the Cold War prior to the birth of ASEAN. That's what we call it, ASEAN, back in 1967. So I don't want to minimize the achievement of ASEAN, but frankly, the powers involved outside of Southeast Asia, notably China and the United States, are so important that to some extent, necessarily, ASEAN is on the sidelines. There is an 11th country, which I'll just mention very briefly so that I can be complete, in Southeast Asia, which is Timor-Leste, very small country. They're not a member of ASEAN, and we don't really need to discuss them in the time available.
Well, I'm interested now that you said that. Fretilin, right, was the liberation movement.
Yeah, there. That's right.
A luta continua, as they used to say.
Well, good. Yeah, you've got a good knowledge there. I was actually an election observer in 1999 when I came to Stanford, and we left when, unfortunately, the capital, Dili, was in flames.
Right.
There were a lot of people killed. It was the one time in my entire career where I actually felt that I could die given what was happening, the violence and so forth. I have vivid memories of Timor-Leste, but fortunately, it's now at peace, and so that's just history.
But ASEAN was not created to be an alliance with China or against China or with the United States, right? I mean, explain, when other acronyms, you know, people think of NATO, for instance, this is not a NATO-like structure. Explain the difference.
No, it's not at all a NATO-like structure, nor is it anything like the European Union.
Right.
This is a loose association of 10 countries that are very proud and jealous of their respective sovereignty. So ASEAN actually, in a way, doesn't even exist. I mean, it exists in so far as there is a secretariat in Jakarta. But, you know, the secretary general of ASEAN, I mean, it's every time there's a new secretary general who comes into office and there's a welcome dinner and he stands up and gives a speech, and he always begins with a joke. He says, you know, I'm the secretary general, but frankly, I'm more of a secretary than a general. And that describes ASEAN.
Okay.
It really does, it seems to me. So ASEAN is about as far removed from an Asian NATO as you could possibly imagine.
Well, what does China think about that? China thinks of this region. You mentioned historically the big empires, or did you use the word empires?
I did.
I didn't want to put
the
words in
your mouth. Civilization.
Civilization, that was a better word. You mentioned India and China. China obviously has a long history in this part of the world. And after a period of decades of weakness, and some would say, you know, a couple hundred years of weakness, China seems to be asserting itself in Southeast Asia. What's the right verb that you would use to describe China's new presence in this part of the world?
Well, I guess it depends on how diplomatic you want to be.
I'm going to let you answer the question.
Assertion is a shade short of aggression, right?
Okay.
Certainly assertion would cover the two dimensions. I mean, obviously there are more, but the two main dimensions of China's presence and its outreach in Southeast Asia now. One dimension is economic. And here, it's not aggression. It is assertion. Southeast Asia is located on one of the two arms of this very complex and vast set of connections that is known as the Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI, a tremendous commitment on the part of Xi Jinping, the president of China, involving, you know, it's very opaque, so we don't even know the number of countries involved, but they run as high as 90. I've heard numbers like 84 and so forth, reaching all the way through the South Asian portion of Asia, linking up into connections that actually run up to Europe. So it's a very clear indication of the ambition of Xi Jinping to spread China as an economic actor around the world.
And why is that bad?
I'm not saying it's necessary.
I mean, I don't know. I want to problematize it.
I think there's
Belt and Road. I've never understood why it's the belt. What does that signify?
Well, you know, these are, of course, English translations of the Chinese.
Right.
But essentially, the belt is called an economic belt more or less across land. And this runs from Beijing all the way to Europe. But it's essentially, not entirely, I admit, but essentially across land. Whereas the road, which should be a land term, is actually maritime, primarily maritime. So it shouldn't be called a road. And that runs right through the South China Sea and up the Malacca Strait and on westward through the Indian Ocean. And I think like many massive undertakings, as this is, the BRI really is, there are good things and bad things.
Okay.
The good things is that China is providing capital for the development of infrastructure. And Lord knows, Asia desperately needs infrastructure.
Yep.
So that's a good thing. The bad thing is the way it's being done. It's being done opaquely. We do not know, with this very little factual information, statistical information, including very sensitive information, such as when China makes a loan, what rate of interest does it charge? Now, these are not gifts. They're all at commercial rates. And this leads to a problem that is called debt trap diplomacy.
Okay.
Debt trap diplomacy happens when China comes in. A dramatic example is Sri Lanka, but there are evidence in Southeast Asia, in Laos, for example. China comes in and says, okay, we're going to offer you these loans. If the government
build infrastructure, right?
Yes, to build infrastructure.
Infrastructure.
But infrastructure very, very widely interpreted. I mean, including cyber, including, and frankly, these efforts to focus on infrastructure are accompanied by comments, as happened in Thailand. I had a wonderful conversation not long ago with a Thai expert on the Belt and Road Initiative in Thailand, who said, you know, when the Chinese come in, they say, okay, we're going to build a high-speed rail. But, by the way, we would like what I would call extraterritorial rights on either side of the railway so that we can put together, you know, all kinds of businesses and so forth on land that we would, in effect, own, at least under a 99-year lease. And, you know, the Thai's saying, wait a minute, that's colonialism. We're not interested in that. So I think it's fair to say that the criticism of the Belt and Road Initiative has been particularly strong lately for these kinds of reasons. But that's the economic effort.
So that's number one.
That's number one.
Number two,
however, is security. And this really has to do with the South China Sea. The South China Sea is, in a way, the maritime heartland or heart water of Southeast Asia, if you look on a map. Now, it's true that China is a literal country. They have a beach, right? They have a coastline on the South China Sea, but it's only about 20% of the total circumference. The rest is Southeast Asia.
Which countries, just if you can remember them, to help our listeners that are part of Southeast Asia?
Yeah.
Part of the South China Sea, excuse me.
Okay, so if you start, if you're looking at a map and you have China in the north, and then you have the Philippines, and then you have Malaysia, and Brunei, a small inset in Malaysia. And then you move on and you have Vietnam. So Singapore is in the Malacca Straits, and it's technically not bordering on the South China Sea, but it depends on exactly where you draw the line, okay, how you define the South China Sea. Now, it must be said from the very beginning that Southeast Asian countries, Indonesia also borders the South China Sea, Southeast Asian countries themselves have over the years made claims to the land features in the South China Sea, and based on those land features, to water around them. But China claims the whole thing. I mean, basically. Now, I have...
And what's the rationale? That, again, forgive me to laugh, but on what basis? Like,
well, on a historical basis.
It goes way back then.
Yeah. They say, listen, you know, centuries ago, 1,000 years ago, Chinese fishermen were using the waters in the South China Sea. You know, this has always been ours. Uh-huh. Now, you know, frankly, that's just not true. In fact, the Chinese completely omit a different perspective, which notes historically accurately that Malay fishermen have been using it for centuries. And actually, the Malay civilization of Southeast Asia was so dynamic centuries ago that actually some of them traveled all the way across the Indian Ocean and ended up in Madagascar, which is on the east coast of Africa. So if you go to Madagascar and you're hearing people speak the language called Marina, it actually is a cognate language with Malayo-Polynesian, which is a major family of languages in Southeast Asia. And a colleague and friend of mine who's done excellent work on this topic actually has identified markings in the little pieces of land in the South China Sea where Chinese apparently have come in and put a marking together indicating that somebody visited this piece of land back in 1842. And, of course, it's modern, manufactured in China in the 20th century, right? I mean, it's a complete farce, right? So I'm sorry, I'm being very, perhaps I should be more objective and give some credit to the Chinese claim. But it is simply not true that historically the South China Sea has belonged to China. Frankly, back then, the whole notion of state sovereignty didn't really exist.
It's different, right.
And I remember vividly talking to the highest ranking Chinese official with whom I have ever had a personal conversation, who I would prefer not to name, having a conversation. And I said, why don't you explain exactly what part of the South China Sea is yours and what part isn't? Because that's not clear. They've drawn a nine-dash line without specifying the longitude and the latitude. The opacity is striking. And my conversation partner, this very high-ranking Chinese official, said, Professor Emerson, we love ambiguity.
Interesting.
She even said, ambiguity is fun, right? And well, it may be fun for China, but it's not fun for the Southeast Asians. So I would argue that what China has done in the South China Sea, including building up artificial islands and putting weapons on those islands, right, militarizing the South China Sea, that's very close to aggression.
And what do you think is the long-term objective here? Like, it's caused lots of tension in the region, but yet we know from other historical examples of rising superpowers that sometimes countries maybe want to cooperate rather than fight with their big aggressive neighbors. What do you think China's trying to accomplish by this assertion, to go back to that very useful word?
I think, again, one would have to separate those two categories. On the economic side, I think there are lots of objectives that involve the Chinese economy.
Okay.
You know, in terms of sending Chinese capital abroad to earn a return when the return is declining domestically, I mean, I could go into that argument.
So they need to do this for economic reasons, to keep things going back home.
Yes, right. But that's an insufficient, I mean, it may be a necessary, but it's also an insufficient explanation, because the sweep and scope and the penetration that is involved in the BRI indicates that they are interested in influence, especially through debt trap diplomacy.
Right.
That's a question of control.
Right. It's not just economics.
And
right.
Control is the theme when we talk about security. China wants to control the South China Sea, paragraph.
To do what once they control it?
Well, number one, to prevent the Americans, especially American naval vessels, from entering the South China Sea.
Why does that bother them? Just help me understand the strategic thinking.
Well, if we look back at Chinese history, in fairness to the Chinese position, they were, quote unquote, invaded by the colonial powers from the south. Those powers came across the South China Sea. And so China says, look, you know, our vulnerable underbelly, right, needs protection.
I see.
And if we, and they don't say, of course, that they control or want to control the South China Sea, but clearly if they did control the South China Sea, then they would be able to prevent Japan, the United States, for that matter, India, other large powers being involved in what they consider to be their neighborhood that okay. really belongs to them.
All right. So whether we agree or not, but that's the logic of why they want to.
Yeah.
But take it a step further. Let's say they started to stop American ships going through there. Like, how does that help their long-term security interests? Wouldn't that create a conflict with us? Is that the beginning of the next Cold War?
Well, very, very recently, at a time when Trump administration staffers were meeting in Beijing to talk about the trade war between the United States and China, at that particular time, and I think this is a coincidence, incidentally, I don't think it was intentional, an American naval vessel, a cruise missile destroyer, went through the Paracels, which is a group of land features in the South China Sea. And as has happened before in these so-called freedom of navigation operations, where the American Navy purposely sends ships into the South China Sea in waters that the United States considers to be international waters.
And right? most other countries, correct?
Yes, not? Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
So those are international waters that go
right,
through?
That's right. International waters to, you know, defend the principle of freedom of the seas, in a sense.
Right.
And the Chinese, every time, have responded. And, you know, the message comes from whatever the installation is on that particular island, or maybe it's a Chinese military naval vessel that says, get out. Basically, these belong to us. You're in Chinese waters. Leave, right? Mm-hmm. And that has happened again and again and again and again. And, of course, some outside observers, as well as in Southeast Asia, worry that that could lead to a physical confrontation and possibly even the beginning of a Sino-American war. Now,
how worried are you about that?
I am not worried about that as much as many other people
I'm
are.
I'm glad to hear that. Tell us why. Yes.
Because the
need
Chinese
to end on some good news here.
The Chinese are smart. They cannot challenge America militarily right now. Now, they may be able to do that because they're expanding their military mm-hmm. and improving it, you know, every day. But for the moment, I don't think it's rational, and I'm sure they would not think it's rational to launch a war with the United States. And conversely, I don't sense under the Trump administration any desire for a war with China. Now, that's not to minimize the complaints that the United States has with regard to China, both on the economic side and also on the maritime side, trying to defend the principle of freedom of the seas. But I am not as alarmist as others are.
I'm glad to hear that. I mean, there does seem to me, Don, that there's been a spike of metaphors about the Cold War with respect to the United States and China. It seems to me it's come out of the blue. I can't understand it. I mean, as somebody who knows a little bit about the Cold War, I think there's lots of dissimilarities, probably way more than the similarities, but there has seemed a kind of rhetorical spike here in the United States. Is that true in Southeast Asia as well? And
there is certainly concern in Southeast Asia. Very recently, a survey was done of more than 1,000 sort of influential individuals in the 10 countries of ASEAN.
Okay.
And one of the questions that was asked was exactly this one. 70% of the respondents were worried not that there would be a war, but that there would be conflict. Now, that conflict could be minimal. There have already been incidents in the past.
Right.
Involving Chinese and American aircraft, for example,
right.
Coming together in one case with very tragic circumstances. The Chinese pilot was actually killed when
right.
the crash occurred, as you may remember.
Yep.
But I don't think there is the kind of alarm that those metaphors, particularly the so-called Thucydides trap, you know, that
right.
we're at the beginning of a Peloponnesian War,
right,
which I think is, frankly, a misreading of history and also a misreading of what's happening in the region. And it's also fair to say that although the Southeast Asians realize that China will always be their neighbor, and the Americans are, you know, way the hell on the
yes.
other side of the planet, for God's sake. So
right.
it's logical that they would worry about the need for American reassurance that America still cares about Southeast Asia. And let me just say one other thing, because it seems to me to be very timely. In December of 2018, an amazingly nonpartisan initiative took place in the American Congress. Very few people know about this. Cory Gardner, a Republican senator from Colorado, and Ed Markey, a Democratic senator from Massachusetts, got together and proposed an Asia Reassurance Initiative Act.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, wow. And it was signed by Asia Reassurance Initiative Act. You know, the abbreviation, I'm not sure how many people still watch or listen to opera, but it's ARIA, right? ARIA. ARIA. So it's an ARIA. And it was signed by President Trump on the 31st of December, 2018. So it's now actually law. And it provides for $1.5 billion every year for 5 years to essentially, I mean, I could go into the details, reassure Southeast Asia.
Interesting.
You know, I had a chance to meet with Cory Gardner when we were together in Singapore for the Shangri-La Dialogue in May of 2018.
This
congratulated
is this big gathering
him.
Of all leaders in the region, very high profile.
Exactly. It was fascinating.
Kind of like the Munich Security Conference of Asia. Right?
Yes, I'm sure. Very similar, I'm sure. And so I'm delighted, frankly. I think that because
so
it's...
So that's the right thing to do.
That's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's what helped keep
the peace. And the other thing I'll mention, if I could, going back to this survey, is that let's not think that the Southeast Asians are so enamored of the Chinese that they're going to sort of roll over on their backs.
Right.
No. In fact, one of the amazing results in the survey, when it was asked, is China a benevolent and benign power? You know how many, what the percentage of the respondents was who said yes? 9% said China is a benign power, right?
Uh-huh.
So China lacks the kind of soft power that the United States still has in Southeast Asia.
And that gives us an opportunity to engaged and to reassure.
Exactly.
Don, this has been fantastic. We're going to have you back. Oh. My guess is that we're going to be hearing a lot more about this region.
Yeah.
So let's make sure to have you back on World Class.
Well, you're very kind. I enjoy the conversation.
Thanks. You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you like this episode, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.